Niara Isley joins us next. She's an abductee, and she'll be sharing her story with us, along with Melinda Leslie on Coast to Coast AM. Now, coming out after more than 14 years of silence, Niara Isley will speak about her experiences with military abduction trauma and her process of recovery. As an experiencer of extraterrestrial abduction contact from childhood through adulthood, and a very strange military lab-type experience as well in the Air Force, Niara has gained deep insights into the workings of our world and the roles that different groups of both humans and ETs might be playing. Here's Niara Isley on Coast to Coast. Niara, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Good to have you with us. Melinda, you're still with us.
Yes, I am.
Niara, tell us a little bit about your story, and why are you coming out after 14 years of silence?
Well, a little bit about my story. If anybody has seen the documentary Dreamland, mm-hmm. done by Bruce Burgess back in 96, you got a little piece of it there. Basically, to make a long story short, I discovered I had 3 months of missing time. A friend was asking me about my military time, and we started going through it chronologically, and suddenly, from January to March of 1980, was pretty blank. I could tell you where I worked and what I did, but I didn't remember any of my coworkers. I didn't remember any day-to-day details whatsoever. And having a pretty sharp memory on a lot of other counts, I found that very disturbing. And I also had a wave of nausea when I realized that 3 months were missing. Then I had hypnosis with Bud Hopkins in 94, and some of this came tumbling out at that point.
Now, you're in the Air Force, right?
Yes, I was.
During this time period.
Mm-hmm.
And when did you, Niara, start to feel strange? You know, you had this missing time, mm-hmm. but, I mean, what was it like?
Well, there was kind of a precursor to that. After I got out of the Air Force, I was having heart palpitations, really nasty ones, where the heart would take off at a mad gallop and it would feel like somebody was choking me at the same time. I did manage to bring that under control without medication by doing yoga-type breathing, deep breathing, pranayama practices. And then another thing that happened was I had all this free-floating anxiety, and it got so bad I almost decided to take my own life age 33. So those were some of the precursors before I even discovered that there was missing time.
Now, Melinda, I want to ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
With cases like Niara, where they want to take their own life,
yeah.
I mean, we're talking serious business here now, aren't we?
Well, the whole abduction subject is very, I can even just start with the alien abduction subject, is extremely difficult for the abductees to live with, to live their lives with. It has a tremendous impact on their whole life. They're afraid of losing their jobs, should someone learn. They're afraid of a loved one leaving them. I have cases, and so do other researchers, but I have specific cases that I've worked with of abductees who have gotten divorced over this, had their significant other leave them, have had their children taken away from them. I know of a particular case where someone had a messy divorce and they were trying to use this against them to take their children away. I know of a case where that was succeeded, and I know a case where luckily the abductee fought it they did not succeed. I know of another abductee who I've mentioned before on the program, and you've had her on, Leah Haley.
Yes.
Leah Haley, she might not want me to say this, but at the risk, has had her children, her grown children, disown her and has lost contact with them because of her sticking with the subject. And unfortunately, this is often the case. And then of course, it's compounded with the people who've had these covert ops things, because it a subject so difficult to already live with, you have another part added to that. And And you're put through so much in the experience. I mean, not only are abductees put through so much in the abduction scenario, and not all experiences are traumatic by any means, but many of them are. But the trauma comes in not so much the experience, but having to live life with it. That's where the trauma is the feeling of isolation, being alone. There's no one I can talk to. Everybody's going to think I'm crazy. A lot of abductees end up having, you know, these I won't say emotional problems by any means. They're incredibly strong and sure. resilient individuals, but will have these emotional breakdowns. And unfortunately, there are abductees that have attempted suicide, sure. this kind of thing.
Well, and they turn to others who are interested in the field of ufology and abductees, I think, for that that support group thing.
Exactly.
Need.
It is so necessary. If you're an abductee who's having any difficulty coming to terms with your experiences, first off, you know, without risking, you know, they call it colorizing your experience and stuff, meet a researcher or a therapist. I mean, thank God, you know, Niara here met Bud Hopkins and was able to work with him. You know, there's so many people out there doing this work. There are a few networks that exist. There's OPIS, as I said, there's the Mentaldo's network. I know of people. Certainly there's Bud and Dave. And, you know, but anyways, you can connect up with different groups. Find out who's in your area.
Well, and they care. That's important.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's find out from Niara. Niara, you've got a bachelor's degree in social work, right, from California State University?
Yes, I do.
I mean, so, you know, not that I'm saying people who don't have a degree, you know, may not be as knowledgeable as you, because, you know, to me, I went through college and, you know what, the School of Hard Knocks taught me more.
Right.
So, you know, I want to put that in perspective. But what I'm trying to say is, you know, you're an educated person. You're not making things up. You don't have any reason to lie about this.
That's what I was going to say when I had hypnosis with Bud Hopkins. Little gray guys with big black eyes, I was ready for. I had never heard of military abduction type experiences. It was extremely disturbing.
I bet you wish it never would have happened to you.
Well, yes and no.
Now
that I've kind of embraced the healing process and have really, you know, I've really reclaimed my life.
Sure. And you've made some friends.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Very much so. That's important. Now, did the military know that you had been abducted, and how did they know if they did?
Well, I have some ideas on that. I read Dan Sherman's book. I believe you've had him on Coast to Coast. Dan Sherman talked about being part of the Intuitive Communicator Project, and he was communicating with ETs, and some of what he was monitoring was abductions. And he would get this scale of, you know, 1 to 10 on different aspects of the abduction that was very disturbing to him, because he thought, gosh, these are human beings that are being abducted. And then, you know, what's this rating that I'm giving mean? So he was actually part of a project where monitoring of abductees was going on while they were being abducted by ETs.
Jeez, what were you going to say, Melinda?
Oh, thank you. So sorry, I didn't want to interrupt necessarily, but I wanted to add, when I myself am familiar with at least 14 cases of this military involvement stuff, of which about 10 of those people I know and have interviewed, but there's about 4 other cases that I know of very well that I haven't interviewed extensively, but I'm familiar with, of which Dan Sherman is one. Here's someone who is an abductee, joins the military, gets taken into this process, as she said, to train and communicate with aliens. Ray, who I brought up earlier, was also used to communicate with aliens, and I'll let Niara get more into that. But in Dan's case, you know, here's someone who had that military on military experience, and to the point where not only did he have alien abduction first, he had reabduction, but then he got in brought into this program and actually, put in a position, within a program to fulfill that role. I just wanted to inject that he was one of the cases I was familiar with.
Niara, tell us what did the military expect from you? What did they want you to do?
Well, I was an auto-track radar operator. AutoTrak is a surface-to-air missile radar, anti-aircraft artillery type of radar, because it tracks an aircraft with a very tight, narrow beam, that's like a targeting. It paints a target on the aircraft to shoot down, in theory.
Okay.
Out on the Nevada test site, we were training pilots to fly against radar. So that was my regular job. But what happened that I remembered under hypnosis with Bud Hopkins was that we were taken out in the middle of the night. I later found out in a subsequent hypnosis session that we were taken out at gunpoint from our motel rooms.
Gunpoint?
Yeah. And we were taken out there in the middle of the night on the radar, and we were told we were going to track some special aircraft. And we tried to track them, and they couldn't be tracked. I mean, they would just appear one place. We might get a bit of a lock, and then they would just be someplace else. There's no way a mechanical servo mechanism can turn that fast.
I wouldn't call them conventional aircraft, would you?
No. Well, they said special aircraft.
Yeah.
And so then after we were done with the test, we were told to stand out on the deck of the radar van. And we were on a crew of people where we'd been given fatigues to wear with no rank insignia and no name tags, no identifying marks of any kind. And we were forbidden in no uncertain terms to speak to each other beyond what was necessary to run the radar test.
Now, Melinda,
yes.
How often is this happening with other people in the military?
Well, like I said, at this point, I am aware of about 14 cases of people who had this happen while in the military.
But these are the 14 that have come forward, right?
Well yes. I mean, these are just ones I met or became aware of. It's like, you know, it's like how I met Niara. It was actually last year's International UFO Congress in Laughlin, Nevada.
Yeah.
And her and I were not speaking or anything. We were attending there. And the producer of that conference, Bob Brown, who I know quite well, Bob said, I heard of this case. You've got to meet her. I want to talk to her. Someone says she's here. And when I talk to her, I want you there present. Well, that was a great opportunity because Bob set it up. He met up with he was friends with someone that was friends with Niara anyways, and he set this up. And Bob Brown and I sat in private and had a chance to interview Niara pretty extensively right then. And so we interviewed Niara, and at that point, Bob said, I've got to have both you guys come and talk about this at next year's Congress. So I met her at last year's Congress, you know, and actually had heard of her case previously through someone else, but had never met her. In fact, had even somewhat forgotten the name. And I was so glad that that opportunity happened, and I learned of her case. And then as a result, Niara and I are now speaking at this year's International Congress, the last week of Laughlin, and there's a link on my website to the Congress. I tell people, check it out. It's this incredible, get a little plug in here real quick, but it's this incredible week-long conference that is like old home week. You don't need to go all week. You can go for just a day, a couple days. You can break it down to make it very inexpensive. But I really recommend if people can go the whole week that they do, just because the sense of family and camaraderie. And then Niara and I are presenting. We're presenting together, but each of us are speaking for an hour. I will cover my research and my new developments in depth, and Niara will cover her story in depth. And so I hope that people will at least go to the website, UFOcongress.com.
Oh, yeah, that's always a great event. I have not been to one in a while. But it is a very great event indeed. Niara, do you think you are giving up any kind of or breaking any security oath because of all of this?
I don't remember signing any security oath about these experiences, but I will tell you that if I did, the things that were done to me were atrocious, and no one should have to maintain a security oath under that kind of abuse.
No, and when you're saying the abuse, you're talking the abuse from the covert folks or from the ETs?
From the covert folks.
Okay. Do you remember anything at all about the ET experience?
Oh, yeah, I remember a lot about my ET experiences. I've had, you know, quite a bit of memory come back from my sessions on that.
How about the craft?
Very, very strange.
Do you remember the craft?
We were on saucer-shaped craft. I remember more the inside than the outside. I don't really recall seeing the outside too much. But, you know, low light conditions, kind of a sound that sounds similar to crystal balls in the background.
Yeah.
and the kind of a ringing sound. I remember that.
And the ETs, were they grays?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay, they all seem, Melinda, they all seem to be grays when it has to do with abductees. Once in a while, we'll hear stories that human-looking ETs are standing by, but grays are always there, aren't they?
Well, not necessarily. Granted, there's a large percent of grays, and even with the grays, there's a couple of different descriptions and differences. Some of them are more tan, some of them are taller, like gaunt and old, some of them are shorter and squattier. So even there, there's quite a variety of that scene. But a lot of people have what are the reptilian experiences, certainly the what's considered Nordic-looking, human-looking, but not quite human, obviously hybrids. A lot of people see what appears to be a human and gray combination, or a human reptilian combination, or reptilian gray combination. A lot of people see insectoid types that,
like the praying mantis.
Well,
types,
yes,
right?
Like a praying mantis, and they can be a cross between a gray and that.
Those would be weird to me if I saw.
Oh yeah,
one of those.
I actually, not to get into detail, but one of my own abduction experiences involved. I was taken from a conference, and a couple people at the support group at this conference ended up coming out and realizing that something had happened two nights before that particular group, but that something had happened where a number of us had been taken together while attending that conference. But what some of the people remembered seeing, besides a kind of a variety of grays, are some insectoid types, and that's the only time in my own experience that I saw this insectoid type. But I'll never forget, it had antennas somewhat, kind of not real large, but these antennas that stuck up that looked like moth antenna, like a feather.
Yeah.
Moth antennas look like feathers, like that. And I was just transfixed on how strange that was. And I had not heard of that before at that time. Since then, I have heard of other people seeing those feather-like antennas. But regardless, there's a variety of types of aliens seen. Now, in these military experiences, some people are seeing aliens with the military, and granted, occasionally it's various types. Very rarely, though, it is predominantly the grays that are seen with the military. At least there are some reptilians seen with the military, but again, fairly rare. It is still predominantly if aliens are seen with them, it's grays.
Well, you know, the grays are the ones reported at Roswell. They seem to be all over the place. Of course, we don't know if they're, you know, biological. We don't know if they're just robots or cyborgs. Who knows what they are, Melinda?
Exactly. And the truth is, we don't. I mean, everybody can speculate, but we don't know for sure. And some abductees feel like they're given information in regards to that. But it's been learned, you know, it's been known in ufology, in at least in abduction research for a long time, that information can't really be trusted. Just because an alien tells you doesn't make it fact. It's just like even in the military experiences, whatever you hear or experience there, you know, your memory may be true, but it doesn't mean that what they told you is factual, you know. But this kind of training thing that Niara had is real typical, and that the military on military experiences quite often involve using the abductee to interface with aliens,
yeah,
in some way. And I think it, you know, I was explaining this to another case of mine. I had this incredible case, an abductee who's come public.
I tell you what, why don't you save that story when we come right back, Melinda, in your website and also Niara's website. They're linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Yeah, I'd love to hear this story of one of your cases. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com as well. My travel schedule, the events that I'll be going to are on our website at coasttocoastam.com. Far left-hand corner, it says calendar. That's what you can click. Well, the last hour of the program tonight, Joshua P. Warren joins us with his paranormal moment as we talk about the wishing machine. It's an incredible story. Next hour, we'll take phone calls with Melinda Leslie and perhaps your abduction stories, if you want to call in on that. And I'll be back with her with a little bit more on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, Melinda, you're talking about a few of your cases. Share them.
Yes, but before I do, you know, your production people are just telling me we were having a lot of clicks and interesting things happening on the line. And I just want to say, you know, of course it could be the weather and just regular technical glitches, possibly. But I'm not surprised.
But you never know.
I'm not surprised given the nature of what Niara was talking about, you know, and coming forward for the like this on the radio for the first time about her experiences. I'm not surprised. You know, your show has a history of when people have gotten into some hot topics, this kind of thing happening. I'm just
tell me about it.
This time, you know, who knows? It may not be related, but I just want to say we were having severe technical difficulties, and that's why I'm back on and not Niara. I feel very badly about it. But what I started to say is something I realized regarding this using abductees in these communication with the aliens kind of stuff is it made sense in this regard. And I was having a conversation with one of my cases, Nadine Lawlich, who works in the legal profession, you know, mainstream, down-to-earth, credible professional as you could possibly be. She actually joined up with Barbara Lamb and wrote a book called Alien Experiences and host a website for that. She now shares her website also with me. So my website is connected through her. So if anyone goes to alienexperiences.com, that's how they get to my website. But we were meeting because she was updating my website and just did extensively. It was great. She added all stuff for me. But in our talking about that, I was telling her about the military on military cases and stuff. And she is not one of those, but she is someone who is one of those, again, advanced abductees who's had abductions extensively and then had the military reabduction. The covert ops reabduction was taken to an underground base, had that happen a couple of times. An amazing, amazing story and just so credible. But we were talking about this, and I was telling her about how they use the people for this communication thing. And she said, you know what, and she gave me tremendous insight because she said, it makes perfect sense. She says, that is so logical that rather than recruit somebody from covert ops or recruit somebody from their technology department to interface with the aliens, and I'm sure they do, and there's a couple of insiders' accounts and stories relating to this. But if they need someone kind of on the spot, how better, you know, than to use an abductee who they don't, there's no acclimation process to get used to the aliens. There's no training. There's no multiple weeks, months, or even years of an acclimation of a training to communicate with the aliens, of just getting used to their presence. They can, you know, pick up some abductee and plug them right in there. And then if it's a military operation that involves military procedures and knowledge and stuff, how better than to use one of their own? So it just made such logical sense that some of these military on military cases would involve these larger programs because they're by-stepping a huge learning curve, a huge acclimation process by using an abductee as opposed to using someone else. And I really think, especially now that I'm talking about this so much on your show, I think I'm really going to get a lot of responses from people who have this type of experience.
The Bud Hopkins, the late John Max, those mm-hmm. kinds of folks still involved in this entire situation, are they getting new cases? What's happening on their end?
Well, sure. Abduction hasn't gone away. And there's even, you know, evidence to suggest that alien abductions on the increase, or that just because the information's more prevalent on it, more cases come forward. It's definitely a big part of ufology. And sure enough, those researchers are, you know, still working with cases all the time, and always have new developments and new information. Unfortunately, John Mack being no longer with us. That he passed away a number of years ago is a very unfortunate thing because he was such a tremendous, person of credibility.
One of the
background
best.
Who brought his career to bear on this subject and offered so much to all of us. And I'm very fortunate to say I met him and he became a friend. Some of these major researchers don't have the military cases. I understand that. Some of them only have a few. And some of them, as I talked, actually when I talked about the one who had 200 but had 12 cases of reabduction, that's Leo Sprinkle I was talking about, who's another one of the most prominent researchers. And these researchers, these abduction researchers have in, you know, in the range of, the, you know, starting at, even some of the more casual researchers have hundreds of cases each, if not like 500. And some of them go up to, you know, Bud and Dave and probably Leo at this point, you know, they're ranging up in like 1,500 cases, you know, each. So it's, you know, they're just dealing with huge amounts of people. And that there need to be more people in this field. And there are. There are people all over who do this research and people who work with abductees. I actually know of some people who are, I can't talk a lot about it now because it's not functioning yet, but they're putting together a real database, a real place where people can go and not only a network, but an interactive site where they can get information on different researchers and support groups and things in their area. And so people, even in some of the states that right now we're not sure if there's someone researching, we'll find that person, we'll find that hypnotherapist who's either done this or is willing to do it and create a database. And I know some people that are taking that upon themselves. And to some degree, Joe Montado has some of that resource with his ICAR organization, but these people are going to include them and everyone else. You know, going to try and take it to the next level, which I think is just a really great thing to do.
How are the memories, Melinda, being erased? How's that happening?
Well,
is it hypnosis? Something?
Yeah, it's hypnosis, and fear and drugs. I think for anyone out there that's a mind control researcher, I got into the mind control aspects of this kicking and screaming. I didn't want to, but it came up in the research, and I had to become at least familiar with some basics about it because it was so prevalent in these experiences, these covert ops experiences. And so what it is it appears to be a use of hypnosis, fear, intimidation, and drugs, and some pain inducement sometimes. So when they drug you and use the hypnosis and mind-altering drugs, plus if they induce pain, it makes the memory stick. If anyone out there is familiar with the Bob Lazar story, it's one thing he talked about in his experience regarding having to drink this white chalky fluid, and I've had that in some of my cases too that I've heard, and the inducement of some pain and some fear kind of thing. They have this. All I can say is they have it down to a science. They've learned how to do it somewhat selectively. So you have this seamless quality. Not always. It's not perfect. Sometimes it's less perfect than others. And these memories can be recovered. A trained hypnotherapist, or even an individual with the strong willpower to say, I want to know. And the individual's willpower, some self-hypnosis techniques, certainly meditation techniques can pull this out. And then working with someone who certainly it helps to work with someone who's trained in working with abductees.
Fascinating. Truly is. How about works? More works in the works for you?
Yes, actually. So much going on. So much. As I said, Niara and I are speaking at the International Congress. A book has been out for about 2 years or so, a couple of years now. I was involved in the process of helping to write a book. My name's not on the cover, but that's okay because I'm on every other page inside it, which is fellow researcher Randy Kopang. Randy's last name is Koppang. And you can go to Amazon.com. He wrote the book, and I realized when you introduced me tonight, you said the research of camouflage through limited disclosure, deconstructing a cover-up of the extraterrestrial presence.
That's Randy's work, right?
Exactly. That's the name of his book. So that it's Camouflage Through Limited Disclosure, Deconstructing a Cover-Up of the Extraterrestrial Presence. And you can get it. There's two places they can go online for this. One is Amazon.com, and I believe I know there's a link on the Coast page.
Always. Now, tell me about Randy Kopang.
Okay, he and I joined up in research years ago because he was researching why there's a cover-up, and he got into that through many different aspects of the UFO subject, and why it remains. Why is there still this policy of non-disclosure? And as he started to write a series and articles and stuff about this, he came across this quote by, I believe by Corso off the top of my head, if I have this right, by Philip Corso, where he said, how we maintain the cover-up all these years is we camouflaged it through limited disclosure. And so that's why he titled his book on that quote. And what the title of the book means is how they've maintained it is exactly that. They have camouflaged it through a slow, limited disclosure process of slowly leaking information out, but that they've always remained in control of that process. And in this book, I tell you, if anyone out there wonders, why is there a cover-up? Why isn't disclosure happening? What are they getting out of it? The technology development, how far back does it go? Really understanding what the problems of that are and how they've maintained it all these years and why they continue to maintain it, please read Randy's book. It's really the definitive explanation. I mean, there's other books that touch upon it, but he really got down to the nitty-gritty of it, of why there's a cover-up and exactly how they've managed it and maintained it. And it's just very insightful. I'm really proud to have been a part of it.
Well, you've done a great job, Melinda, in your area of expertise as well.
Thank you.
Where does the future go in this kind of research?
Well, that's a good question. You know, certainly more cases, more developments. I mean, as a result of every time I've been on your program, I've gotten more cases. Ray, the case I talked about, was someone who I'd been familiar about before, loosely through someone else, but didn't know really anything about him. Because of a result of going on coast to coast, he emailed me. And that's how, you know, how I got in touch with him, as well as other cases. I have another new case. This is someone who herself was not in the military, but her family was. And her father had an intelligence-related position, and they moved all over the world. Now, you were talking about, does this happen internationally? They moved all over the world. And she lived on military bases, military and government facilities, all over the world, in a, I don't know, like 10 different countries growing up or something. She was an alien abductee, but was also having this covert ops stuff starting in her case as a child and continuing into adulthood now. But it started while she was living on these bases. So she was having military reabductions while living on a military base, but she herself was not in the military. But in a couple of the incidences, she saw her father and her mother and stuff involved. So in the case here, we have a generational MILAB case, and obvious easy access to her as an abductee in that she's living in these military facilities, but she had it all over the world. And sometimes it always involved American military, because that's who she was, you know, housed with and stuff. But occasionally it also involved the military of whatever location she was in. And her story about these different locations and having stuff happen is just fascinating. And it literally, you know, followed her from base to base. It's really, and that's another thing I want to say. My cases of people that have had this happen, these individuals like Niara, you know, are so credible. I mean, these people have careers. Like you said, you said a comment earlier, and I wanted to offer something on that about the intelligence and that they have degrees. The people who have had these MILAB cases, like Joe says, advanced abductees, and he's quick to say it doesn't mean there's anything special. I might say maybe there's something that's kind of special. A lot of these people they've accelerated in life. You know, they have.
Well, they've got a little more at risk, I think.
What?
They have a little more at risk.
Yes, yes, and it just seems that, I'm going to say I'm blessed by the types of cases I'm getting. On one hand, that, you know, that feels funny to say that, because I wouldn't wish this on anyone, and these people have been through, you know, hell and back for sure. But But as far as the quality of those cases,
here's a case in point, and it sets the tone for what you're saying, Melinda, mm-hmm. and that is a guy can come out of a bar and say he saw a UFO, mm-hmm. or a police officer can say he saw a UFO,
yes.
and 99.99% of the time, people will believe the police officer,
yes.
than the guy who came out of the bar. It's perception.
Well, and it's funny you should bring that up. One of my lab cases, I don't have his permission to go into detail about this, but I'll say this much. He was a sheriff that, I'm not sure exactly what the title was, but he was like the head sheriff of a county,
mm-hmm.
like the head sheriff in whatever that position is called.
In some state, what's
of a county and of a large county.
In a state.
What?
In a state.
In a state. I'll say within California, of a large county within California, like the head sheriff. And this is one of my lab cases. He's the case, and I actually have pictures on my website, that he had an experience where he...
pictures of what, him?
Well, no, I'm about to say,
if you got pictures on your website, tell us who he is.
This picture is of a boot print on a wall. And then I also have a scar and a needle mark thing that are both from him. It's not labeled that way, but some of those evidence pictures of scoop mark and needle marks and stuff, a few of them are his. But and that's actually from his alien abduction. But the boot print one happened this way. He's staying at his brother's at the time. I don't know if he was living there at the time or visiting. I think he was visiting. He's at his brother's house. His brother watches TV. They're going to plan to go out somewhere or something. So he goes to get in the shower. And he, you know, gets in the shower, right. takes a shower, gets out, comes out of the bathroom with a towel wrapped around him. That's all. As he comes into, you know, opens the bathroom door into a hallway with the towel wrapped around, is greeted by two guys in camouflage uniform, you know, typical military camouflage, and two big guys. And they proceed, and he's thinking there was maybe something put over his nose, if I remember correctly, like a chloroform thing or, you know, something like that. But he does this. And apparently there's a bit of a ruckus. His brother, who's in the living room watching TV, hears this, runs into the hallway because he hears his brother fighting with someone, runs into the hallway and sees these guys with his brother and goes, "Why are you guys here? What the hell's going on?" You know, like this. But he remembers one of the guys leaning up against the wall. Next thing they know is the guy who had the experience is drugged, is taken somewhere, is taken into an underground base. The brother, about 2 or 3 hours later, I think it's like 3 hours later, so anyway, period of time, wakes up sprawled out, like spread eagle on his back on the master bed, like waking up, like coming off a drug. And his brother's gone. His brother is gone. Later that night, if I remember correctly, the guy who was taken shows up in, I believe, in the patio.
Amazing.
It's left in the patio, knocking on the window for his brother, knocking on a sliding glass door that was locked, if I'm remembering correctly, because I haven't looked at this case in a long time, but knocks on the window trying to get in. And the brother said, "I saw these guys. Where did they take you?" You know. But the brother said, "They drugged me, and about 2 hours later, I woke up, he didn't even know
where he went.
But he said, "I saw them in the hallway." And so the brother who witnessed it takes the other guy and shows him where stuff was. And there on the wall where he remembers one of the guys leaning and putting his boot up on the wall, there's the print of the boot.
There's the same print. Stay with us. We're going to take phone calls with Melinda Leslie when we come back, and perhaps also your stories if you've been abducted.